Today is the 27th of November 2017. I'm interviewing Bob Boston of Green Life. Meadows. Bob, would you like to tell us something about your family and yourself?
Well, I was born in Napier in 1931, and I was the fifth child of six to my parents, Winifred and Bert Boston. So 2 months before the major earthquake in Napier, which of course obviously I don't remember, but it destroyed a lot of things with our family. A lot of the children were sent up to Auckland to live with relatives while things settled down, and things were not easy at all for the family. And my sisters were at school at that time, and I can remember the shaking and running home. One of them got lost and the parents had to go out looking for them. So obviously a very sincere time for family. My family originally came out, or my relatives came out during 1660 in England. It started with John Shepherd, who was born in 1660, and their children were shepherds. I've got seven different evolutions of family, which goes down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and the sixth one is my mother, Winifred Ellis, and on the other side it goes down starting at 1795, and it goes down to my father, who was born in 1900. So he met my mother. My father came out from England, met my mother, and they married, and they had the six children. And I married my wife, who was Gladys Joy Nugent, and we had four children, and we had six grandchildren, and they've now had nine great-grandchildren. So it's a busy family life. When I was 15, I took a job. I answered an ad and went to Venables Willis, who were printers in Dickens Street. So I took a job, apprentice for 6 years as a bookbinder, paper ruler. And at the end of my six-year apprenticeship, I became the foreman of the bindery. And I had about 10 women and two men under me. And one of the other employees that had been away in J-Force, that's Jack Martin, he had come back and he decided he'd start a company which would make colour cards for the paint industry and other places like cosmetics for fingernails and powders for faces. So he started this company where he got the actual products and sprayed sheets of cardboard. He had a dye press which cut them into the chip size. He had a machine which would wipe glue over a page with the spots of glue at a certain place, yes, and by hand I'd stick on all these colours. So he asked me to join and become the commercial printing manager, which started up doing letterheads, business cards, account books and everything. So I agreed to do it and I left my job and went to his new rented place. And when I walked in, there was a concrete floor and a couple of boxes. One contained a small printing machine. I forget the other one, but my first job was to take off my eye and start building benches. And then we had to look around for equipment. There was one new machine called a graphic press, and that was the actual printing machine. And we hunted around for a machine, and we found a ruling machine for sale at Whanganui. So I went over to Whanganui and found this machine, and the old pen ruling machine. It was about 20 foot long and 10 foot wide. It was made of all wood. Monstrous looking thing. It looked like a murder or a torture instrument. So I had to dismantle that, bring it back to Napier and assemble it. And that was our ruling machine, which I could do. So the company built up and we employed and we bought more machinery. And it gradually grew up and up. So I was running the commercial printing and Jack was running the colour cards, so it was like two separate businesses. He had machinery to print colour cards and the deposit of the paint, and I had machinery which did the commercial print.
Okay, we'll go back to where you went to primary school.
Right. I went to primary school when my brother Stuart went, and he was exactly 1 year older. I was the 27th of April and he was 15th of April, 1 year apart. So when he was five to start school, I had to go with him. So he was just over five and I was just over four. And I regret this, I mean, convenience. We went to the school together and their lunch, and of course the parents, no participation with parents in those, probably the first day. And so for that reason, I was probably the dunce of the family and Stuart was the clever one, because I never really did catch up with that. Yeah, I was just a kid, just a baby really. So, and I regret that all my life, because I was always behind, and my school reports were dreadful. And then I went to high school and I wasn't very good there, not a good scholar at all.
So which primary school were you at?
We were at Hastings Street School, Hastings Street. And then I went to the intermediate and then Napier Boys High School. And when I got to 15 at the high school, I was in the fifth form and I hated it and I was no good at it, of course. I never did catch up and I was still younger than everyone else all the way through.
Yeah.
So when a job came up, which I saw, I answered it at Reynolds Willis, and there was quite a few applicants, but I got it.
So then we'll carry on now to you started working with Jack Martin.
So the company got bigger and bigger, and then Jack got hold of this man in England who had designed a machine which would do all this paint chips on with an automatic process using the colours in a liquid form deposited in one hit, so they could do 120 colours on one impression done by a machine. Now, the colours that were put on the card was not the actual paint. It was a lacquer. And the lacquers had to be tinted to the colour of the actual paint. So if we're doing a chart with 100 colours, we'd have 100 tins of paint arrive, and they would be stirred up and brushed out onto a sheet. And we would start with the tins of white lacquer with the tinters, there's about 12 tinters, and by eye, the colour tinter, which was Noel Kemsley, who was the other start-up with the company,
yes.
They would look at a colour and say, well, that's green and black and a bit of red, and they do that, and mix it up and take a brush head on a bit of card and leave it and go to the next colour. And they do say 10 colours, and colour when it's wet is different colour to when it's dry. So by the time they've done 10 colours, the first one would be dry. So they'd look at that and say, right, well, that's a bit red. So I'll put a touch more blue in that. And so they mix up and do another brush. And they go through and through. And the average was 1 hour per colour. So if you've got 120 colours, it was a long job. Then they had to go for approval up to head office to Barn Paints or Torbens, yeah. British Paints. And their guy would look at it and come back with a comment. It would just be a bit of card with a brush of the colour. Say, this one's a bit red, and this one's okay, but this one's a bit yellow. So they'd have to correct to that guy's eyes and send him up again until they said okay. And of course, all they were mixing was about a 3-gallon tin of this colour. So when it was all approved, they would all go up to a mezzanine floor with holes right through it where they could take tubes down to the machines, which would go in little plunger holes, and it'd be a matrix made with the shape of the chip die cut out of it. So when it had a machine which had a push-pull system of feeding, you'd push one in and the matrix would come down and would make contact with it, and the lacquer would drop through it a certain amount and form the perimeter of this recessed area and go up, and the operator on that side would pull it out and put the card onto a drying rack. And while she was doing that, the woman on the other side was putting a new card in. So it was a push-pull thing like that. And over the years, we ended up with three machines. And we were working shift work. We were working 7 days a week at times. And we could only work as far as what these racks, they were just thin racks of wood with an upstand about an inch. So you put one on top of the other. We had a trolley that moved them around, big drying space. And of course, because it was lacquer and the fumes, you couldn't have any flammable material.
Mm.
You couldn't have a spark from anything. We had a system overhead, which was a powder spray thing. And if it went off, it would just be like a powder, block out the whole place and probably ruin every card as well. But that was the security of it. And then the next day, they'd take them all out, and then they'd go through a folding machine, and the girls might have to pack them in 25s, a very hands-on job. So we ended up doing all of the cards for New Zealand and for the Pacific Islands. And our nearest competitor was in Australia, and they were part of the same group because the man who supplied the machines, he was Lord McCorkadale, and he was in the British War Office during the war of Lord McCorkadale, so we had to pay rights to use the machine. The lack of smell meant that the girls could only have 2 hours at a time, twice a day, two in the morning, two at night, two in the afternoon. So we'd have probably about 30 women working for us, all being able to go onto the machines for the paint deposit. Then they'd go into the factory and they'd be folding cards. So that was a big, big part of the business. And it took quite a bit of travelling, and Jack really, he used to go to Auckland a lot and Wellington, and I did too at times, because I used to do a lot of travelling for the commercial printing, because we were doing a lot of cosmetic and other things for Unilever, Colgate, I forget all the name now, but big jobs. And a lot of it was personal contact with everyone. And I went to Fiji a couple of times with the colour cards, submitting proofs, in Australia a couple of times with different things. So it was a very bright business with 120 staff at our top.
About when you retired, had the process changed greatly?
No. But over the time, circumstances changed. So what happened was that, I'll just go back through the. At one time, I was approached, and I left Martin Print, and I went out to Cliff Press Hastings Knowles, and they asked me to go to general manager of the company, which I did, and it didn't work out. It was a family business, and I won't go into details, but I finished. So I was actually just mucking around at home and doing a bit of wallpapering, and the chief of Martin Print from Auckland, the big noise, he came down and he arranged a meeting with me. Because Jack Martin had gone to Australia to run that time. Right. And we had people that knew nothing about making colour cards or printing. Mm. In the big world of business, if you've got a good brain and you experience, you can run anything. You can run a glass plant or whatever.
Sure.
Well, in some cases, it doesn't work. And we had managers come down from Auckland who were professional managers, but knew nothing about paint or printing, nothing. And, of course, before that, I was a factory manager and I ran everything except the colour cards. So I got asked to go to a meeting. I was unemployed to meet this high guy from Auckland and the company manager at that time in Napier for a meeting. And they got me to the home and said, we have to tell you that since you left, in that 5 years, the company has gone downhill and it's in a financial state now that we are considering that if it doesn't improve in 6 months, we will be closing down. We'll be moving the commercial print to Auckland and the colour cards to Australia. That's how bad it is. And the staff will be put on. So he says, a last-ditch solution, we're asking, would you come back as general manager and see if you can put it right? So I agreed. And so when I got there, I was amazed to find what had happened in my 5 years away. For example, they were running a canteen with two women cooking a hot meal midday for the staff. So I'd go up and say, how many have you got for lunch today? Two. I said, do you mean there's two people cooking two meals? Right, so gone. So then I go in the office and what do? He said, well, I collect the timesheets and I put in all the information here onto this sheet. I said, then what happens? He said, well, I've finished. I guess that guy. And he interprets it. So I go, and what do you do with it? Well, file it. Right, well, he's gone and he's gone. And it was a real clean out. And I went on for some years and we got back in. And then later on, when I got to 58 and things were running really good and I was the general manager, they promoted me up. One guy died and they said, well, you'll be the manager, now you're general manager. And so it was really going well. So I decided to retire to pursue another career. And I'll tell you about that later if you're interested. So I retired when I was 58 and they had all the big wigs from Auckland came down and we had a big function. We all went out to dinner and gentlemen's club and all this hype out. And managers from around New Zealand came. It was big to do. And then I had to get up and give my farewell speech. And I said, well, I want to say that I am leaving this company in the best shape it's ever been in. I said, I'll run through. We are ahead of budgeted sales, rolling budgets. Mm. We're ahead of budgeted profit. I have renewed for a year all of the contracts for Unilever, Colgate, Taubman's. They're all for another year. And I said, it's as sweet as a nut. So I left my other job, and I was given 1 month to stay on to overlap the other manager. And they advertised throughout New Zealand, and they brought this guy up from Wellington who was manager of a company that made paper bags. It had nothing to do with printing. And he was a career man. So he came up and took over my office, and I went to a little cubby hole out there and said, I'm available. He never asked me one question, and I was supposed to be there for a month. So I'd wander through and say good stuff. He didn't want to know anyone's name, not one question. So I only mucked around about 2 weeks. I thought, I'm bloody off. So off I went. So I pursued my other career, and 18 months later, the big chief in Auckland rang me. He said, I find I've got to tell you personally. He says, Martin Print has gone defunct. 18 months, it's defunct. And we're moving the machinery to Auckland, the colour cards to Australia. They just gone.
And Bob, you felt that starting school at 4 years old was a detriment to
That's
you.
That's right.
And yet you were head and shoulders above.
I was. I had a thing with staff, and they were loyal to me. I knew the staff to select. Example, one time we needed a top printer that could do colour print. Printing machine, you've got four colour heads, so you're printing yellow, green, blue. Red. So I went down to Wellington, and we advertised Wellington, and we had a Wellington office at that time. Yeah, we had an Auckland office and a Wellington office. So we advertised, and I had about six replies, and because I hired staff. So I went down to Wellington, made the appointments. One guy came up from South Island. We paid his fare and a couple. So I went down, and there were six guys to interview at our Wellington office. So I drove down for the day and came back, and Jack Martin says, well, how'd you go? I said, oh, I interviewed six. He said, well, when does the guy start? I said, he's not. He said, well, didn't you get one out of six? I said, no. He said, why not? I said, we want a top colour printer. And not one of them were. So I'm not employing someone that's can't do the bloody job. He said, why don't you buy the best of them? I said, the best wasn't good enough. I didn't do it. And later on, we did get a guy.
Well, just coming back, during your growing up period, you and your brothers and your father were involved in music.
Yes.
The band and yourself for the piano and drums.
Yes.
Could you just go back and develop that before we go on to your new...
New venture. Yeah, well, so my father was the leading light. He was in the Frivolous Minstrels from about 1928, I think. I've probably got photos of it there. 1928, so he was the first one. And we, my brother Stuart and I, were young. I was probably about four and Stuart was five, and he had his cornet there. And a cornet is very hard to blow. You don't blow it like you're blowing up a balloon. You've got to purse your lips. You may know this. But he had his trumpet, and he said, well, when you can both play God Save the Queen, I'll give you a shilling or something. Stuart, he's trying. Well, he got it, and I finally got it. God Save it. So I said, and that's the last time I'm playing it. It was ridiculous. I said, I hate it. Well, Stuart didn't hate it, and he was bloody good. Really good. You know, he ran his own dance band for years. He was really good. And the thing that he perfected is, there's a term in playing a cornet. It's called triple tongue. And triple tongue is where you play a note, and you break it into three, ta-ta-ta, which is a system called triple tongue, where you make one with your tongue and one with your lip. That. So every note you go, ta-ta-ta, ta-ta-ta, ta-ta. You'll hear the famous trumpeters doing it. And he could do it. There's no one else in the band that I knew could do it. He was a wonderful trumpet player. And so I was learning piano from Mrs. Bromley Hill. She was the pianist in the Frivs in those years, and my father was in that as well. Later on, my brother played in the Frivs, trumpet, and later on I played drums in there. So, you know, on the piano, I didn't really like it, and I learned it for a few years, and then I started playing modern music and that sort of thing. And at that time, my cousin Ernie Rouse, who ended up being a great pianist. We used to muck around together, and in the end we started a little dance band where he played piano, I played drums, and we had a lot of people play with us. So that was our start to music. Where else do you want to go?
You played over a long period of time.
Yeah, we did. And the thing that broke it up was that when I was 20, I was married. I got married, and I got called up into CMT training, 3 months. And it was done by a ballot, so my month of April was selected for 3 months. And at this time, I was married too, just got married. I got married at 20. And my wife was expecting, not because we got married, just when we were married. So she was only early stage, so I went away for 3 months. And of course, at that stage, I couldn't play in the band, and Ernie got someone else playing. And I never actually slotted back into it, so that was the end of that. And then later on, I played with different people, Bill Mayer and different ones, not the same. Ernie went on to play great things, make records and go overseas, but I wasn't included in that at that time.
Janet Totty. She used to be Janet Shaw. She was a good piano player. Yeah.
And there was another woman called, I forget her first name, Hare. Her surname was Hare, H-A-I-I, somebody here. Anyway, I played with her, but anyway, that was the end of that part of it. But when we first started playing it with Ernie, I had a bass drum, a snare drum, and a cymbal, and bits of gear, and we used to go along our two push bikes to play, and we'd go and play at Sunday school things or the church, odd things, and you can imagine carrying a bass drum and things all on your bike. And then we played at, there was an old time dance in Hastings, and we played there for about 4 years, every Saturday night. And then we'd play rugby, and away we go.
So who'd you play rugby for then?
Tech Old Boys. And because I was the smallest one, I played in fourth grade, and Ernie was there, and my brother was there, Stuart. Anyway, I was a reasonable player, even though I was small, and I played halfback, which size didn't matter too much. Anyway, I got into the Napier Rep team, and then I went up to third grade, next one up, and I got into the Napier Rep team, and we went to junior, and I got into the junior Napier Rep team, and then we played senior. Well, I didn't get in the Rep team, but I played in the winning year team of Tech Old Boys Seniors. And we had one of the famous players called Bowman, and in 1938, I think, he was an All Black. So he was the mainstay of our team.
Sure.
Yeah. But anyway, we won this competition beating MAC at Hastings, and I got so badly hurt, I actually didn't play again. We won 6-3. I got taken off twice and came back on the field. But we had great players, and Alan Coots and Jack Hunt, they're all Hawke's Bay players, and we had a really good team. So after that, I did nothing for a while in rugby, and then my sons were playing schoolboy rugby, ninth grade, and I used to go over to watch them like a parent. And one day I was over there, and the coach of one of the team said, look, it's the school holidays, and we used to get the boarders at the boys' high school to come and referee. And he said, and at the moment, they're all on holiday. He said, now, you've played senior rugby. Here's a whistle. Will you referee the kids? Oh, yeah. Well, of course, I referees kids, and you realise that refereeing, you've got nothing to do with playing. Totally different. So I did this for a few weeks, you see, and I thought, well, the best thing I can do is get a rule book. So I found out where the Referees Association meeting was, which was under the Harris stand there. So I arranged that I would go and pick up a rule book. So I walk in, and there's all these referees there, and so they come in, and the chairman says, we'd like to introduce you to the new referee, Bob Boston. Take a seat here. And I'm sitting there, spellbound. And then at the end of the night, they have a lecture by the head chaplain on the laws of the game. And at the end of the game, they said, we read out the appointments. These are the ones doing senior, these are the juniors, and these are the ones doing schoolboy referee, and I'm appointed to a bloody game. And that's how it started. No thought of it.
Yes, but you obviously had the talent.
And I was quite fast. And so anyway, I got better and better, and you go up to junior referee, and after a certain time, if you're good enough, you can sit the New Zealand theory exam. It's a 3-hour written exam. So they asked the whole book. So I thought, well, I got it. At this time, my wife was sitting a dancing exam. She was a Scottish dancer, became a teacher and judge. So I was going to be the referee. So she was sitting, and I'd sit there with her thing saying, what's a plio and what's that? And she'd answer the question, and I'd question and answer. So with my situation, I had been at work, I cut a bunch of off-cut white cards like a playing deck. And over a period of nights, I went through the rule book, and there's 33 rules. And on one side, I'd write Law 32 and what was the rule. And on the back of it, I would write the answer. So I'd write, what is a scrum? I turned over and I'd write, a scrum is formed when three people from either side get together with people supporting them with the ball to be put fairly in between them by a halfback. That was word for word. So I'd write it. So I went through the whole book and I had a stack of cards. Okay. So I would go through that stack of cards and then I'd give them to my wife. I said, right, ask me the rules of rugby. So she'd say, what's a knock-on when the ball is propelled by the arm of the player and the opponent's dead ball line? That's what a knock-on is, word for word. And I got faultless. So I went to this exam, it was a 3-hour exam, and I finished it in 2.5 hours. I said, Christ, I mean, you can take my cards in, wouldn't you? Some didn't finish in 3 hours. So I finished it and went out quite happy. So when the results come out, they come to the rugby referees, and we're all sitting in the room and said, well, the results have come out. He says, some of them didn't pass. He said, Bob Boston passed, and he got the highest marks in New Zealand at 98.5. And they return your papers. And I went through, and I got 3 half marks deleted. That's why I got 98. And they weren't wrong. They weren't full enough. Like it said, there's a 5-yard scrum and the attacker's taking the ball. What's your decision? What's a 5-yard scrum? Yeah, but you didn't say the attacker puts in the ball. Wrong. Well, not wrong, not full. So I had 3 questions like that where I didn't give the ultimate answer. But I still got 98.5 and I still got that.
I think starting at 4 years old sharpened you up for everything you've done in life, because everything you've done has been successful, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, wait, I'll tell you, these next bits coming. So anyway, so I went up to a senior referee and I started refereeing big games. And then I refereed my first Hawke's Bay game, which was Hawke's Bay East Coast, as I mean, not a very prominent game. But because in Hawke's Bay, we had all these good players. We had Tremaine, Abel, Furlong, Mackay, anyway, All Blacks. And even on Saturdays, I was refereeing all of these top players. Nate Oldboys of Tremaine, wonderful time. So then I refereed another Hawke's Bay game against Wairarapa or somebody. And then I refereed another game with Colin Meads, who was the captain, King Country, and that was the ultimate, my Colin Meads. And it was funny, I penalised him a couple of times because Colin was a great talker on the field. So I had him on a couple of times and I took him up 10 yards. So at the after-match function, of course, all the Hawke's Bay and all the rugby officials were in the big meeting room. So Colin gets up to give his speech. He said, well, I want to thank the referee for his game. He said, I tried to help him with some of his decisions and he didn't want to know. He says, I just let him get on with it and do it. That was quite good. So after that, when the international games came, they had to have senior. You couldn't referee an international game in your own province. You had to do it as well. Of course, at this stage, I'm getting up to 35. So I was touch judge with big games like Australia playing Hawke's Bay with an international referee. Who else? Wellington touch judge. And that was the game where we drew 6-6 or something, drop kick in the last minute. And it was another. I did 3 games anyway. But I was touch judge on a lot of the Ramfordly Shield games.
Sure.
Magic. So you're part of the whole fun. You went to the rugby union after, you went to the pub with the international.
Yes.
And when I got to 40, I said, that's it, I'm retiring. Top of my grade. It's like when I left Martin Print, I was the top of the grade. Successful company, and I'm the general manager. And I moved. And the same with refereeing, I was the number 2 referee in Hawke's Bay. I had all the experience. I'm not going to wait and go downhill. Top of the game, retire.
Yes, I used to work for Kel Tremaine.
I had a lot to do with him.
He was a man who had so much to give.
He did. I'll tell you one thing about him, which you might be interested to know, seeing you know him. When I tossed up, if he was a captain, when you tossed up, you 2 different captains. You toss up and say, now, what do you want to do? And one will say, oh, we'll play with the wind. Or the other captain might win, say, oh, we'll play against the wind, or we'll play that way. That was their choice. Now, with Tremaine, if he won the toss, say, what do you want, Kel? He said, we will attack that end first. Isn't that a better expression? That's fighting talk, but we'll attack that end first. So there's something for your memory. There's one you can tell to a lot of people.
Yeah, I see quite a lot of Simon's story.
Yeah, well, you tell him that.
Because that's what he was like.
Yeah, but quite often on the field he would question me, and I took him up. He'd say, oh, that's not right, ref. And I'd go up 10 yards, and I took him up three times once, 10 yards, and then that's it. Never said another word, ever. But he wanted to run the game, you see. And of course, he could do that to a lot of referees, and run the game, like a lot of All Blacks can do it. So that was my refereeing. So learning that exam, that was the key to it.
But, see, you had a method in your madness, didn't you, by creating a system that you could learn it all.
And I passed it on to other learning referees as well.
There's one or two out there probably need that help now too.
Yeah, because it's all different now. I wouldn't know where to start now. Far more technical. But the referee today, they run the game. They say, get back.
And they're calling, they're talking all the time.
All the time.
So then we have another part of your life where you met your wife. Where did you meet her and what was her name?
Well, her name was Joy Nugent and she was part of the family that lived in Wairoa. And they came up to Napier to live, and her brother Tom was in the Tech rugby team, which I was in, and I was half back, and he was playing wing. So we got quite friendly, and I was in the Frivs playing drum, and she was on stage. And he said to me, Tom said, my sister's in that too. He said, sometimes you have trouble getting home, living at the port. You know, if you ever feel like it, you could run home. So I did. I ran home. We twigged together and we got engaged and then later we got married.
She grew up in Napier?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, you said Wairoa, didn't she?
Yeah, she came from Wairoa with her family, but then she was about 16, I suppose, when she came. When we got married, she was 19, I was 20.
And so what did she do?
She worked at Harris Hats as a machinist.
Yes, that was a big company
Big company, and a lot of friends there. So that's what she did, because I was at the printing, and we got married at 20. So she was a dancer, and she's got her exams for teaching in Highland. She was a great dancer, and she was a judge. And in her early married life, she'd go out to Mariah Carco or out the stick somewhere as the judge, and I would go with her and drive her out and be with her. So she'd be there, and she'd have to write reports for all the things, and she was very good at it. She did that for a number of years, and teaching as well.
Yes.
And we converted our double garage in Miani Road. We put on a proper tongue groove floor where she could teach. And she also went up to, in the Wairoa, in the rail car, to, what's the first stop, not Wairoa? Halfway to Wairoa, where the lake is, Tutira. And she taught in the hall up there, if you sat there. She had quite a following of pupils. By the time you come back on it.
It's interesting the influence Scottish dancing had in our communities. I was interested hearing Evelyn Foster talking about Ahariri being a Scotch and Italian fishing village, which I never realised. And it had its own pipe band, had its own dancing.
And that was the Frivs Hall, which is down the road, in Waggon Street.
Once a year, the Frivs came to Havelock in the old St Luke's Hall, and it was the turnout of the year. I still remember Vic Vigors and Wally Ireland.
Yeah, me too. Len Dadson. They did one show, they did a lot of country. I'll tell you this one, which might amuse you. They had a skit going that they'd make a guy disappear somehow, and then later on something would happen and he'd come in the back door. So anyway, they did this show. And what they didn't know is that they were next to a river that was tidal. And when they got there, because there's only just nothing, but during the show, the tide coming, and this guy jumps out the back in the river, and he comes in all dripping. And there was one act they did. There was one guy that was a big, tall guy. I think it was Len Dadson. This is when I was at school, and they had a reduction thing, and they had this tent there with a guy he wanted to get the 6 foot, and the guy would go in and there'd be smoke coming out. And anyway, they had the act, and my brother and I, we started on late nights because we're still little boys. So, of course, the sparks come out of the sudden, and they take away the curtain, and of course, Len's gone, and us little kids standing there with all this old clothes.
It was good fun, good clean fun, though. And so, married life and children.
Yeah.
How many children?
Two. After we married 3 months, my wife got pregnant, and then I went in the army because I was out before the baby was born. And 3 years later, we had second one, and George couldn't have any more after that, so we just had the two. So he got very successfully. My son David, he went to university and he got a BA degree in Palmerston. We were very proud parents. And he was learning guitar off a Napier guy called Bob Ross. And he taught him guitars for 2 or 3 years. We were paying. And David went to Bob Ross one day for his lesson. And Bob Ross said to him, "I'm sorry, there's no lesson today." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I can't teach you anymore. So today and in future, we're just going to play together. But I'm not teaching you because I can't teach you anymore."
Isn't that a wonderful thing?
Yeah. So he went a couple of times. But anyway, he went to Australia. He's had a BA, and he went to Australia, and he's working some firm there, and he didn't like it. So he rang me one day from Australia, and he said, "I'm coming home," because by this time he was married and kids. He said, "I'm coming home. I wonder if I can stay with you for a while." And I said, "Okay." I said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "Oh, I'm going to play my guitar." I said, "Doing what? Well, how are you going to earn your living?" He said, "I was just playing the guitar." Christ. So I said, "Well, I wish you luck." Anyway, he comes back. And the next thing, he's teaching. And it went on. And now he's teaching and has done for years, 12 schools.
It's very well known.
Private pupils every night after school till 6:30, all day Saturday. And exams, school exams. And he's had a couple of pupils that have won the Young Musician of the Year, including my nephew.
So he's doing exactly what he loves.
Exactly what he wants. And every 2 or 3 years he goes over to Spain and sees all the big wigs. But that's his life. And there he is up there with his daughter. She's a wonderful, she's a professional musician too. So he proved me wrong. So he's got his own nice home and a purpose-built studio, the whole thing. And the other one is a motor mechanic. And I took him for his first interview at Monarch Motors in those days in Hastings Street. I went with him for his first interview. And he got the job, and away he went. And there was some months later, they found out he was colourblind. And the way they found out, they said, "Go and get that red car and bring it in over here." And of course, he brought in a blue one. And of course, nowadays, apprenticeships aren't available in a lot of things. If you're colourblind, you can't be an airline pilot. You can't be a train driver. And you can't be a car painter. There's so many things. But anyway, and he still is colourblind, of course, it doesn't change. So he's all right.
I tried to join the Air Force for my CMT. I couldn't because I was colourblind.
Did you have a colourblind test?
Yes.
What was it like? What did they do?
They had all these little dots all over the page.
Right. Well, I had one of those colourblindness tests. I had a guy applying for an apprentice, and I got him, and his father was in the car, and I was in the office, and I got there, and I interviewed him, and I got this colour test, and I said, "What's that number?" And he said, "There's no numbers here." I said, "Well, it's a 6, so I'm going to turn the page." You know, so everyone he said was wrong. So I asked his father to come on. I said, "Have a look at this." And I'd say to his son, "What's that colour?" He said, "6. And his father said, "No, son." He said, "That's an 8. He said, "No, no." And his father, I said, "Your son is colourblind." And he couldn't believe it.
Grandchildren? How many grandchildren have you got?
6 grandchildren. We've got 2 girls and 4 boys.
Right. What are their names?
We've got Jacob, Nathan and Anna, one family, and Joshua, Sean and Naomi. So one is in England, he's married, he's now turned 40, that was the first one, so it was Jacob. And one is in Auckland, that's Nathan, making a wonderful career out of music with guitar. He's the one that won the Musician of the Year. Brilliant. He's in a group called Whitechapel Jack, and they go all around the North Island playing. Big function. They play at the rugby test match at half time in front of 30,000 people. That's the stage he's at. And they might get flown to Wellington to play at a function and flown back with accommodation and $1,000 each or something.
And that's 2 of them.
Well, and this one's, she was a school teacher, Naomi, school teacher, and got all the degrees for teaching. So she teaches privately and teaches at school, and she's got 3 kids, so she doesn't do a lot of it. And the other brother, Joshua, he's a high flyer in financial circles, big job, staff under him, and a big salary, new home. And one of the younger ones, Sean, he's just started to become a school teacher, 3-year term. The one that went to England, he was the bright bugger, Joshua, and he started his own company, all to do with computers. So I'm really not sure what it was. But in the end, he sold, he had a partner, and they sold their business, and he's a millionaire. And now he and his partner have started another company. And when you hear him, he's in Ceylon, or he's in Burma, all around the world for his business. And they're developing things to do in hospitals. I don't understand what it is, but it's big money.
Wonderful to hear the success of the younger ones. Right, now coming back, you retired and you started another adventure.
The adventure was that I had already been doing it, but this time I thought, well, there's enough money in this to do it full time. And what I was doing was, and I'll tell you the story how it started, I went to Melbourne on business, and I stayed on a Saturday, and there was a big game of Australian rugby on, where this in a big circle. And when I left the ground at the end of the game, there was all these things happening at the gate, people buying scarves and caps, and they were buying coaster of the game, of the two teams. So when I got home, I thought, now, those people going out there, if that coaster had the score of the game on, that'd be a lot of money.
It would.
Be worth a lot of money. So I had already set up my own bindery, because I was a bookbinder, and I had a press, I had a power guillotine, book presses, the whole thing. And so as an experiment, I got a couple of blocks made for the base of it with a border. One of my machines was a die cutter. So you put something in it, would cut to the shape of the die, sure, it would be a triangle die cutter. And one was a gold blocking press, second hand that I bought. Gold blocking is that you have a die which is recessed. The part that's bold is what's going to press, and the stuff that's recessed doesn't press. And you get that heated up, and you press it onto the board with a foil, metallic foil, and the heat transferred to it onto the bottom. So I had all this gear. So anyway, I thought I would do a sample. I did a sample, and I was going to a big party down in Wellington, so I sent one out for this guy's 21st birthday. Here, and this is the date. Handed all around, they all impressed, you know, it's got his name on and the date. So I did that to a few things, and then I saw there was a school jubilee coming up in New Plymouth. So I made a sample up and I sent it to them and said, I can do these coasters as a commemorative of your jubilee coming up, and here's a sample. So I said, I will bring a sample over to you to New Plymouth. So I drove over and I saw the girl, and I put them into, I had a special box made that folded up, was stamped on the jubilee as well. So you open the lid and there's six coasters. So first of all, I showed them one. They said, oh yeah, we might want 300 of those. And I said, yeah, well, okay, well, here they are in the box. Well, we might want 300 boxes. Oh, yeah, I thought you might. So there we go, expansion. So then I could write to anyone that's having a jubilee in New Zealand. So then I got on the rugby. And there was a game in England. It was New Zealand playing Wales. So I had it prepared, and I waited, and I had the score numbers set up in type that I could pick out a one or a two or a three. And I had the background all done and die cut, whole coast. So I listened to the radio, and the score, whatever it was 8-6. Set the type, overstamped the score, and I went down the pub. Here's a coast of the game. Christ, the game only finished an hour ago. That's right, yeah. So he took it home and showed his neighbour. So his neighbour rang, look, we want. So pyramid zone. So then I started doing it seriously. And after a while, I approached the rugby union and I went down to Wellington to use the silver fern, which is a protected thing. And I agreed to pay 10% out of my sales to them. And I went in production. And then the tour, the first tour that came, I think it was 82 or something. And the Lions came to New Zealand. And when they played Hawke's Bay, I got in contact with somebody I knew involved in the rugby union. And I went to his office, and he had with him the manager of the Lions rugby team. And I said to him, look, pleased to meet you. I said, I'm going to show you a sample of what I'm making under jurisdiction of the New Zealand rugby union. And this is the result. There's that little pack with six coasters, which will have the monogram of England and the monogram of New Zealand and the four pools of the tour. So I showed him, and I said, what I'm going to do is when the game is at Napier, I'm going to approach the supporters team. There's about six busloads of them coming. And I'm going to show them what I'm doing, and I'm going to take their orders and make them. And the day after the test, I will deliver them, you know, with a score on. So I got all these orders, and they wanted to give me money. No, don't give me money. I might have an accident or something. And no money, nothing. I'll be there in your hotel, North Shore, Rendezvous. I'll be there 9 o'clock. the morning after the test. So I would be all set up. I'd have everyone finish except the score of the last game. And that would finish at 4:30. I had my family. I had the type. I had the machine heated up. And it was just a manual machine. Put it in, score, out, score, score. So the whole family, and we'd finish, say, at 1:00 in the morning. We'd make up all the orders, load up the car with my son, drive through the night to Auckland. We'd arrive, say, 8:00 in the morning. And the first time I got there, the team was in their bus and the motor was running. And I drove in and they said, oh, here's the man with the coasters. And I drove in and I met the guy, the leader of the tour party, and we went to his office and I had all these coasters and he's got all the money. And I can show you pictures of this. Got all the money, they put the money in the car. And of course, they took them back to England and they showed them to their clubs. They all want them. Everyone wants them. So I did the Lions and the French. And I had a ring from Canada. They were bringing a team out to New Zealand. They rang me from Canada. How do you make these things? So then I used to put them into picture frames, a wall plaque. So I met my wife because I was playing rugby with her brother. I think I mentioned that earlier. So she worked at Harris Hats, making hats, very good sewing. And she used to make patchwork goods, which I've got samples of on my beds here. Beautiful stuff. She's a great worker. And she learnt dancing, and she's a very good dancer. And I've got heaps of ribbons that she's won and certificates that she's won. And then she became a dancing teacher, and she had to sit this exam, which she passed with honours. And she used to go out judging dancers out at Onga Onga and all around the countryside, really. And I'd go with her as a driver and just to help her there. So she did that for many years. And she was a great ballroom dancer as well, and very light on her feet. So we were married 53 years, and we'd been overseas several times, and we had planned before we got to retirement age to do a major 3-month trip. And we were going to Europe again, which had always been, but we were going to Israel and Egypt, and we were going down the Nile, and we were going to the Masada, which always intrigued me, and the pyramids, we're doing all that, and we're going to China, to the warriors in there, and all those things we hadn't done, because we'd done a lot of travelling. So we booked our ticket, and we paid $30,000 up front, and we got all our visas, and about a month before we're due to go, we were lying in bed on a Saturday morning, and I put my arm around my wife affectionately, and I said to her, I can feel a lump in your breast. So she shot out of bed, sure enough, a hard lump, about 1.5 inches long, about 1/2 inch deep, hard as rocks. So she got dressed, went down to the doctor, and he said, it looks like cancer. You'll have to go in for a check. And they booked her in for the next Friday. And she said, well, if they do a biopsy, they put her out and do a biopsy. If they find that the biopsy is definitely cancer, don't wake me up and tell me it is. Just do the operation. And that's what happened. We all went out. It was Princess Alexandra at that time over the port. So she goes in there, has the biopsy, and I check it, I know it's cancer. And they come and tell me, well, we're going to have to do a mastectomy, remove the breast. That's that. So they did. And she was quite in good spirits after that. But it wasn't good. And, of course, we cancelled our trip. So that cost us a bit. We lost about $5,000 because we didn't get money back for all our visas, sure, and all the costs. So anyway, that was gone. So we never did go. So after a couple of years, she seemed to be pretty good, and she became president of the ladies' bowling club at Omaranui. So she was going all right and playing bowls. So we said, well, we'll do a little trip. We'll go to Australia, and we'll go to Ayers Rock, and up the Sunshine Coast, we did all that. So we did that, and we went on the Garn train, which went from Adelaide, and at that time only went to Central Australia, Alice Springs. So then we took a trip out to Ayers Rock, climbed a bit of the rock and all that sort of thing. But she wasn't really well, and we came back and we didn't go away again. And she gradually got worse and pain. So she had to go to the doctor every month, and they would x-ray her, check it out, and she was on pills. And then she had to go to the hospice, and we went 7 weeks the first time, and she didn't get any better. And in the end, she ended up taking 23 pills a day. And I took her to the doctor in Terradale finally. She wasn't very good. And after his examination, I said, well, okay, when my wife got out the door, I shut the door to the doctor's office, which left me. I said, I don't want my wife to know this, but I said, how long has she got? And he said, she's got no more than 6 months. I said, right, well, my wife doesn't have to know that. She died 6 months later, almost the day. So anyway, when we got home, she couldn't do anything. She said to me one day, she was going around the furniture like this, holding on, and she said, I've got to say, I can't do anymore, you're going to have to do everything. I said, well, that's no problem. I said, I'm bloody near doing it now. So, but I'm quite happy to do that. And eventually we moved a single bed into the dining room, and we moved another single bed in the dining room for my daughter-in-law, who was an IC nurse, and my son, and they came and lived here for the last 3 months of her life. And we had the hospice people come in and give her injections for pain. She had on a timer. So they came in, and then she went into a coma, and the medics came in the day and they said, we're going to put an extra injection there. We're going to put another one in the other leg, another one here, and we'll come in tomorrow. And I said to the nurse, will there be a tomorrow? And she said, probably not. And there wasn't. She died at 4 in the afternoon. So we had a big family funeral.
So how long
ago? So she was 72, and that's 13 years ago. That was that. So I left in this big house, four beds.
You can never read what's going to happen in life, can you?
So I had a few lady friends and said, none of them's worked out. And I think when you've had the best, it doesn't happen. So that was that episode.
Now, coming back to
Coasters. Yeah, I was on a business trip to Melbourne, and I went to the Australian Rules game there, and there's 55,000 people there. And I said to the guy next to me, is this the final? He said, oh, this is only a club game. He said, it's pretty big. And in the end, I was like a lot of people, there's no seats left. And in the end, I got two empty beer cans and had them there to stand up so I could see. That's how busy it was. And then the thing was, as it finished, all these thousand people went out there, and they were all buying these mementos, which were caps and scarves and bottles and all sorts of things with the names. And it gave me an idea that if I had something saleable like that with the score on of the game, and they walked out with that, they'd sell big time. So when I came home, I pursued that idea, and I thought I could do it with rugby. So there was a test match on the radio. So I prepared all this. I had the gear to make these coasters, to stamp them out in gold foil, and to die cut them into shape. So as a preliminary, I waited till after the game, put the score on them, and I went down the pub and gave them to a few people. They took them home and showed their next door neighbour, and they took them to work, and then it was like pyramid selling. So that was the start of my career. So from then on, when the tours of the Lions and Springboks came to New Zealand, I would contact the tour parties and show them a sample of what I was going to make. And at the end of the tour, I would deliver them to their hotel in Auckland the day after the tour, just before they left to go home. And I would arrive with all of these coasters in various ways with the score on of yesterday's game. So I would take their orders, but no money. And when I arrived, I would hand over the coasters to the tour leader, and he would over a handful of cash for me. So that's how it all started. So I went on year after year after year. Springboks and Lions.
How many years would you have produced these?
1981 was the first tour when the All Blacks went to, I think it was they played the Lions or something like that. That was the first one. And then next year they toured here. So after a couple of years I thought, well, this is too much. I haven't got time to go to work. And at the same time I was making labels, real labels as well. All the labels were really small things, like the biggest was about 2 inches by an inch. And I had this little machine that would stamp all the labels. And of course, all these things are so small and the orders so small, like 10, 20,000. The printer wasn't interested. For a start, they couldn't do them that small on the reel. And this was a reel fed and a reel delivery with the labels die cut on this extension reel. So I used to get all the orders through work, which we couldn't produce. And we would normally have to send them out to another producer. So I sent them out to myself and charged the company, and they'd put their markup on. And another thing I did then was, I haven't told you this, but we produced the colour cards, as I mentioned earlier, for the paint industry. And with every order, we used to have to send out and get, say, 1,000 of the paint colour cards laminated, both sides. Well, it's not laminated, it's laminated with plastic, but it's really called encapsulating, because encapsulating means it's slightly bigger than the actual card, and it's clear sealed right round, so liquid can't get it. If you guillotine it, you get water. So that's what you call encapsulating. So we used to send out, we did these, and they were the different shops that sold the paint to have on the counter. So every shop wanted one, so there'd be 1,000 ones that'd be encapsulated. And we'd have to send them out, and it was a hassle. You have to send the cards out, and we'd wait and wait. So the easy answer was for me to buy a machine and do them myself in my garage overnight. So that's what I did. And the company would put their commission on it. So everyone was happy. The customer was happy, they got them straight away. I was happy because I didn't have the hassle of getting them done. And the company was happy because we satisfied the customer and they made a profit.
Do you know Trevor Page?
Yes, Page Plating Company. They're around the corner from us.
But just amazing, really, that sometimes you people undersell yourselves by saying you started off on the back foot, but you were 10 years ahead of most of the other people.
When it came to business.
That's right, and that's what counts.
I have the ideas, I can produce the ideas and make a hell of a lot of money out of it.
Yes, so then you got to a stage where you mentioned once rugby became professional, things changed.
There's no tours. They'd fly in and play a test and go home. And it was professional.
So you decided at that stage to fold your tent?
Yeah, well, the rugby union wanted so many thousand up front, which I hadn't done before. And the commission was set at 10% to 15%. So sure, it could fit in with what I was doing. But the fact had gone professional, and I was old, been in it for 20 years. Forget it. I don't need the money anymore.
Now, did you ever fish or bowl or do anything like that?
Yeah, I bowled.
Whereabouts?
I bowled at the Omanuri Bowling Club. So my son's father-in-law, Jim Deere, he was a great bowler. In fact, he won New Zealand something bowls. He's a good bowler. So I started off with him, and my wife did too. But in those days, the bowling club was a women's club and a men's club.
That's right.
Using the same facilities. But we didn't play with or against each other. So it's two separate clubs. And you couldn't get into the club unless someone nominated you, because it was a closed membership. Well, I got in and Joy did. I was ended up on the committee there, and Joy became president of the ladies later on. And then later on, the club amalgamated, so we were one club and played together as well. You played women or men's or combined. So I was there and I played quite well. And the second year I was there, I won the junior men's singles championship, and later on I was in the team that won the men's triples championship, and I had five, when I was skipping my own team, I had five championship runner-ups. Five! But anyway, two of them, they used to have the New Zealand RSA competitions, and they had the Tauranga one. It was a two-day competition, 2 days, quad. So the first time I went into it, I picked up my own team, and they weren't sort of high-profile people, but people that I used to play with in graded teams. And we went in and we played for 2 days and we won it. So we went off, all expenses paid, to Blenheim to play in New Zealand finals. Well, we didn't win it, but we did pretty well. And then the next year we won it, and we went to Palmerston. And the next year, we got second, and we were due to go to Invercargill. But because of the cost, they decided they wouldn't send anyone, which is fair enough. So those are my three big wins, apart from a couple of championships. So a big part of my life, and my wife, we played mixed bowls together, and a big part of my life. When I got to 80, I decided I wouldn't. Well, might have been 75, I decided, well, that's it. That part of my life is finished. I don't want to skip. If you skip, you've got to walk up and down all the time and on your feet. Done my share. So I gave it up. In my younger days, I played squash purely for fitness to be a rugby referee.
You've certainly seen some changes run.
I have.
Sports-wise.
Yeah, in the printing industry.
The opportunity to sell mementos. many people have ideas, but that's all it is.
One time at Martin Printley, we had a... This is not the manager that let the place go bang. We had another manager before him, professional manager, and he didn't know anything about printing. He was a professional manager, and he wouldn't make any great decisions on his own. So he said to me one day, look, I've been to Adelaide, and I've seen this machine that does die cutting of labels. You know, you print labels on a big sheet, and if they weren't square labels, they'd be shaped like neck labels and things. He said, I've seen this great thing, and he said, I think that would be ideal for what we do, you see. But he couldn't decide. So he said, I want you to go to Adelaide and decide. Now, he's the manager. So I go over and looked at it and come back. I said, that's a machine for mass producing like hundreds of millions of labels for the whole of the South Island wine place. I said, we're a little New Zealand here. They produce New Zealand's nearly contacts after lunch. Bloody ridiculous. And then he was in Australia and he said, we need another machine. He said, I've seen this machine in a big printing place here. I've gone over to see it because it's a second-hand machine. It's a four-colour printing press, a Japanese machine, Ikimai or something like that, and it's still running. He said, I want you to go over and assess it and buy it. No, why couldn't you? No, you got it. Right, so I go over and I'm talking to the operator and I say, how's the machine going? Oh, not too good. He says, it does this and does that. I said, yes, it's the top of these Japanese machines. So the engineer that I went in with to check this out, he said, there's another machine I'll get you to look at for sale. He said, it's undercover. It's been taken out of this business because they went bum. But it's a good machine and it's a Heidelberg, German, top of the range, four colour. He's going for a song, $250,000 or something. He said, I'll show you. And it's still on the wrap, not even running. And I looked at it and made my conclusion. I said, yeah, right. So I go back to Napier and I made out a report. And he said, right, well, when does the machine arrive? And I said, well, the one you want me to see, we're not taking that. We're buying a Heidelberg. Well, it's only my recommendation. But there it is. It's a Heidelberg. It's only a few years old. It's undercover. The deal is that we're buying it for $200,000 with a new machine warranty, guarantee. They are shipping it to Napier at their cost. They are bringing engineers out from Germany to install it and to instruct our staff. That's the deal. So I had to go to head office. Done.
Yes, it's funny how you hear names like Heidelberg.
Yeah, big name. Well, in our factory in Napier, we had more Heidelberg machines than any other company in New Zealand. Heidelberg letterpress offset machines.
I guess you had them because of the quality. You buy them once.
Yep. Yeah. It was like a Rolls Royce of printing. They were expensive, but they were good and good backup.
So what do you do now? You have given up bowls? You don't fish?
No. What I do now is I play cards, 500, up to 4 days a week, four afternoons a week. And I play indoor bowls, all of these at the senior citizens. And the indoor bowls are on raised tables. So I play at Napier Senior Citizens on Tuesday. I play Taradale Senior Citizens on Wednesday, Friday and Sunday, should I want to. So that's six afternoons a week. I play cards or bowls.
The bowls you mentioned are raised?
Raised tables, about that high. So you don't have to kneel down on the floor, which getting older is hard.
That's amazing. I've never heard of that. Well, I started playing indoor bowls when I was about 15, but I always found the bending.
Yeah, the getting up. Well, a lot of them have a wooden stick to just lean on. Still got to get down and get up, and then you've got to walk up the other end. So indoor bowls are miniature outdoor bowls. Yeah. Almost the same rules. You're the bias bowl.
And you're socialising and using your skills.
We play two games. You either play mainly as fours, a number of people, fours or triples or pairs. And you play one game of 18s and then you play a different team on a different table. Then you have afternoon tea and you're home by 4 o'clock. Well, this takes your time now.
Well, we've got a recording room at Stonycroft. It's a big two-storey house. Anyway, a friend and I, two of us do interviews, most wonderful history. See, today we've found out things about the printing industry I had no idea. But I didn't remember all the other things about you. The drumming.
Oh, it was only a few years in the band with Ernie.
So, can you think of anything else that we haven't covered?
Oh, no, that's pretty good.
Okay, well, I'll just finish by saying thank you, Bob, for sharing the life of your family and your life with us.
Yeah, okay. I don't know how it happened, but my father had an old, old car, and he didn't want it. So the simplest way was to dig a hole in. We had a great big chicken run with all the fowls. So he buried it. And when we eventually moved, some other bloke bought it, and he dug it up and restored it. So here's a photo out of the newspaper and a write-up about how he found it and restored it back to its original. It's quite a talking point.
It certainly is. Bob's just going to tell us now about his son, the guitar player, receiving some awards from
Government House. So my son David Boston, he learnt guitar off a guy called Bob Ross when he was a young guy. And when he got to about 16, he went for his lesson and the instructor said, "There's no lesson today." And my son said, "Why not?" He said, "Because I've taught you everything I know. So therefore you just come and we'll play along together at no cost." So that's how quickly he learnt guitar. And he ended up teaching in 20 schools in Hawke's Bay and private pupils. He built his own studio and his whole life is that. So a few years ago he got mentioned and awarded the Queen's Service Medal, and we went down to Government House in Wellington with me and his other son that is also a guitar player to receive his medal. So we're very proud of him, and he's still teaching today.